Hello, this is Doug Clark Jr. podcasting from Louisville, Kentucky, recording episode 7 of Working Class Spark on December 15th, 2018. Welcome to the 7th episode of Working Class Spark, where the news is for us, the workers, not for them, the rich and powerful. Thank you for listening to this episode, and let me begin by describing to you what this podcast is for. This podcast is for sparking the working class. It serves as the ignition for workers' power against the rich and powerful who have their foots on our throats. It serves as a spark for street politics and collective action. And through these methods, we must fight for our freedoms and rights as human beings. This podcast is a rallying cry for you, the worker, the worker's advocate, and the desperately unemployed to stand up to the rich because workers have been screwed by the system. This is what this podcast is all about. At this point in the episode, usually I like to do terms of the week, but this week I'd like to give a more of an explanation of exactly what angle that this podcast is coming from politically. As I've stated in the description of this podcast, Working Class Spark comes from a radical leftist point of view. Now, the forms that make up a radical or far left system of government are socialism, communism, and anarchism. Now, don't turn off after hearing that. I know what people think of when hearing of socialism or communism. They think Stalin, gulags, purges, mass starvation, but those are the result of authoritarianism rather than a radical leftist government. A true form of socialism, much less communism, has never been practiced in history. And what a true form of radical leftist system is about putting power in the hands of the workers. Workers should own the company they work for because they are the ones who are doing the labor. Right now, major stockholders on Wall Street own and control the factories and corporations, but they do nothing but sit and make the profits while we make crumbs. They don't unload trucks, sort freight, work a cash register, fill orders, or what have you for at least 40 hours a week. The fruits of our labor have been torn away from the rightful owners, that is us, the workers. Now, if a far-left system were to be won, the government would take power over or socialize the factories and corporations in the name of the people. And at some time in the future, they would be democratized for the workers. But I know what you're thinking right now. You're saying, how can a corrupt system like ours ever turn over the power to the workers? The answer is we smash the current approach, the so-called democratic system. It must go. Now, which form of a far-left government we construct in this place is for debate. And in all honesty, I'm not sure which one exactly it should be. But what I do know is right now socialism is the best form of government we have. And under socialism, you own your car, your house, all of your personal property, but the people own the big companies that serve our needs as equals. So in general, I believe the best practice for creating our new society is we must take the best ideas from socialism, communism, anarchism, and yes, our current capitalist democracy. And we must leave behind the gulags, purges, and mass starvation and collect the best ideas from the far left. So in conclusion, the view of this podcast comes from the socialist point of view. I take the best ideas of our four forms of government outlined above to build a fair system for the working class. And though it sounds extreme, our current democratic system must be smashed. Any ideas or thought would be very much appreciated on this topic. All right, for the first news article of the week, it's entitled The Gilets Jaunes. It's from the BBC, and it's posted on December 14th. Please let me warn you beforehand that I'm going to murder the pronunciation of the French language here. I have absolutely no idea how to pronounce 90% of the French terms here, so please bear with me. On an ancient monument near Republic, fresh graffiti scars the old gray stone. Its garish scrawl, a slash of anger above the pigeon serenely scratching beneath the arch. Down with caviar, long live the kebab. A lone shout in the breadcrumb trail of slogans marking the path of protesters through Paris last weekend. This boulevard of the French capital became, for a few hours of that day, an urban battlefield. Under vast posters showing their latest releases, lines of riot police and armored vehicles filed past the grand old Rex Cinema. In front of them, protesters pulled together barricades from street furniture as trees were set alight and tear gas filled the air. Franck, who wouldn't give his real name, was among the protesters on Saturday. A construction worker from the Calais region, he says that he supports the protests and came to Paris with four of his friends to join them. They were carrying gas masks and other protective gear. Franck was prepared for trouble. His friends, he says, were looking for it. By the time they arrived on the boulevard near Republic, they were part of a group of more than 100 people. They were overturning cars, breaking shop windows. They set fire to anything they could, he says. I'd never seen anything like it. Total chaos. It was war. Everything was on fire. Bins, cars, the protective hoarding around shops. The police charged us. The atmosphere was very tense, and the protesters, we all felt like we were in it together. Grinch protests have often seemed like a dance between demonstrators and police. Direct action has a long and cherished history here, but these weekly confrontations between people and state are different. Not led by any union or political party, the Yellow Vest protests have unleashed the worst civil disorder Paris has seen for decades. Four people have been killed, many hundreds injured, and billions of euros of damage inflicted on the country's urban centers. The French government at one point warned of serious violence and fears for democracy and its institutions, with at least one protest spokesman calling for other people to march on the Élysée Palace, the home of the president. There is a difference between legitimate protests and unacceptable violence, the government has repeated time after time. And yet the power of this movement lies not in the violence at its margins, but in the quiet support of what polls suggest is more than half the country for its basic claims. President Emmanuel Macron came to power vowing to face down protesters and drive through long postponed economic reforms. For the first 18 months of his presidency, that's exactly what he did, forcing through changes in the labor law against a backdrop of noisy public protest and bulldozing past broad union-led demonstrations on railway reform. This current crisis erupted not over a flagship issue, but over a fiscal detail in the budget for next year, a routine rise in eco taxes on fuel. It wasn't even a policy that the current government had made. The commitment to annual tax rises on fuel, and especially diesel, in order to fund eco-friendly projects had been part of the previous government's legacy to Macron. But it was enough to spark a small local rebellion. A handful of motorists who started displaying their regulation high-V jackets or gilets jaunes in the windscreens of their cars and posting their actions on Facebook. Now, a movement created on social media with no recognized leadership has forced President Macron into concessions that were unthinkable a few weeks ago. How? Because this is not a confrontation about fuel taxes or any one issue. It's about power. It's no accident that cars were the spark that ignited this anger. Not needing one has become the status symbol in France. Those in city centers have a wealth of public transport to choose from, but you need to be rich enough to live in the center of Paris or Marseille or Bordeaux, and most people are not. Economic growth happens in big globalized cities, but the working classes no longer live there, says Christophe Guillet, an independent researcher specializing in human geography. That's a major change. For the first time in history, they don't live where wealth and jobs are created. They live in a peripheral France, characterized by weak economic growth, high unemployment, and high anxiety. This economic model creates enormous wealth, he continues, but it creates it in a concentrated and unequal way. Since the 1980s, what we are seeing is a weakening of all categories of the middle class. Outside the ring roads that encircle Paris and other French cities, you will find the suburbs and satellite towns where workers like Mireille Benicia live, and the gap between the world she works in and the one she can't afford to live in is growing. She commutes into central Paris every day to work as a receptionist in a smart hotel just off the Champs-Élysées. After this month's violent protest in the capital, she says the hotel has emptied and bookings have nosedived, but she has little sympathy for business owners here. To be honest, I still have the same salary, so what does it change for me if the business is not working or not, she says. I still have to go outside Paris to live and come into work every day. If the protests were more peaceful, maybe I'd join them. Without a car, those in France have been priced out of the big cities. Would struggle to get to work, take their children to school, and even to shop for groceries. Petrol prices here are roughly the same as in Germany or the UK, and French diesel prices generally lie somewhere in between its two neighbors. But there is a more general sense of unfairness, a feeling that the struggling middle class are being asked to shoulder more than their fair share of the burden, while France's millionaires have seen their top rate of tax slashed. And the pain was felt especially keenly this year because rises in the global oil price had already made fuel more expensive. In September this year, the government announced its planned increase in the eco taxes levied on petrol and particularly on diesel. Shortly afterwards, the first motorists began showing off their high-V jackets in the windscreens of their cars, and Jacqueline Marod, a hypnotherapist from Brittany, published a video on social media that motorists were being hunted. Months earlier, Priscilla Ludowski, the manager of an online cosmetics company from just outside Paris, had launched a petition on the website change.org calling for petrol prices to be lowered. After the announcement on tax rises, it really began to take off, quickly gathering a million signatures. But still, she says, there's been no response from the government. We are not understood. We are not heard. Our opinions are not sought on big decisions, she explains. I get the impression that when the president speaks to people in the street, he's completely detached from reality. Then, in October, truck driver Eric Drouet, another initiator of the movement, suggested on Facebook the idea of a national blockage, calling on protesters around the city to block roads in their area on November 17th, obstructing and slowing traffic in order to get the government's attention. About 290,000 people took part. The Gilets Jaunes movement had begun. The movement started around the tax rise, said Christopher Gulli, but I think it's simply a pretext in the same way the Brexit is now fundamentally a confrontation with Europe, but first and foremost, a way for people to say we exist. In France, people are using the Gilets Jaunes as a way to say we exist to the elites, to the political class, to those that have forgotten about them for the past 20 years, for the simple reason that they no longer live in the same place. The Christmas tree overlooks the motorway toll at Lake Cigote, 45 minutes drive outside Marseille, its tinsel and baubles catching the light from braziers flaring in the drizzle. The protesters here, as on the blockades across France, are settling into Christmas. Their tents are well stocked with food and drink from local well-wishers, and the noise from supporters honking their horns as they pass along the road frequently drowns out conversation. More than a dozen people stand around in their high V jackets, well wrapped up in hats and gloves against the cold. Many protest sites like this one have developed into semi-permanent camps, snaking along the roadside with plenty of cover for the elements and supplies of basic necessities stacked neatly on wooden pallets. Many are 24-hour operations, and more often than not, they are small rivalries and animated discussions over who should speak for the group. Antonin Olay is a retired technology teacher. He says social media has played a key role in creating this movement and restoring to people here a role in the national debate. The government wasn't aware of the power of social media and giving a voice to people who weren't being heard, he says. Beneath the ear-splitting blares of passing lorries, not only does it let people air their grievances, it also lets them communicate with people who feel the same way. These people don't often get to speak to the TV or newspapers. It's a way for them to mobilize, to show they exist. Some have questioned whether the movement was helped by a change to Facebook algorithms. Posts from companies and the media became less prominent, with individual contributions given a boost. But, as with other social media uprisings, the roots of this one runs deep. Guy says France is no longer just looking at an economic or social crisis, but a democratic one. You have here groups that have not been represented for a long time by the big political parties. Those who joined this movement are those that vote least, the most disengaged from public life. They wanted to have their voice heard, but they haven't had a way to do it. Olay thinks that politicians, union leaders, and representatives have all been discounted. People ask themselves, how can this person stand up for me if they don't know what my life is like? They are relocating everything from villages to big cities. There are fewer local schools, fewer local doctors or hospitals. One woman needed a helicopter ambulance to take her to hospital in time to give birth. It's no wonder people feel like they're being abandoned. The irony for Emmanuel Macron is that he came to power promising to rebuild trust in politics, especially among those struggling to thrive in the new globalized economy. This is the last chance, he told me on the campaign trail last year. If he was to fail, next time it would be Marine Le Pen. The reforms he promised were designed, he said, to create wealth in order that it could be shared with those who needed it most. It was a policy that aimed to liberalize and protect, but many here feel that the social protection for workers has fallen short compared with the liberal reforms enjoyed by businesses. President Macron pushed through the reforms where previous presidents had feared to tread, reducing the power of the unions in workplace relations, ending the special benefits enjoyed by the railway workers, and making it easy for companies to hire and fire staff. He also ended the wealth tax on all assets, apart from property, meaning a 70% cut in the tax for France's millionaires. It was meant to boost investment in the economy, but it was seen by many poor voters as further proof that this former banker-turned-president was still primarily a friend of business, not of the squeezed working class. France's Public Policy Institute recently published a review of who had gained and lost under Macron's presidency so far. It found that the buying power of the poorest in society had slightly shrunk, while those in the economic middle had slightly gained. But the biggest winners were the richest 1%. This sense of unfairness emerges time and again in the graffiti that has appeared on walls and monuments in Paris. Much of it calls for the resignation of Macron, or simply the fall of the regime. On the Republic's famous monument at Republic, someone has changed the revolutionary right of universal suffrage to universal suffering. If the roots of protesters' frustration lie in the big economic shifts of the 1980s, how far did Macron himself encourage it to bloom into open opposition? In the last election, many people voted to change their situation, and they find themselves here, so they started to get frustrated, says protester Antine Ollet. They've realized that those who govern them don't know what real life is like. For them, poverty is just a few set of numbers. Despite his warnings against populist nationalism, there have been times when President Macron seemed unaware of the tensions swirling beneath the surface of French society, leading to criticism that he's aloof and out of touch. At a public event at the Élysée Palace earlier this week, he told 25-year-old Gardner, who complained of not finding work, that he would find a job easily if he applied to hotels, restaurants, or construction sites. "If I crossed the street, I'd find you one," the president told him, "so go ahead." After 4 weeks of national protest, he addressed the nation in a bid to satisfy demonstrators and drain the movement of momentum. What he offered was the most significant climb down of his presidency so far: a monthly bonus of 100 euros for those on the minimum wage, an end to tax and social changes on overtime and workers' annual bonuses, and a freeze in some pension charges. There was also an admission that he had sometimes got things wrong. "I know some of the things I've said have hurt you," he said, but there was no formal apology and no change in the government's economic course. Further reforms planned for next year on pensions and unemployment insurance are still set to go ahead. Instead, the president's response was to look for solutions at the local level. He announced an unprecedented national debate on the environment, immigration, decentralization, and political disengagement. He also said he wanted to meet France's mayors region by region to build the basis of a new contract with the nation. The town hall at Le Pin-sur-Huet, 20 minutes drive from La Ciotat, is painted salmon pink. Three huge French flags fly from the poles above the entrance. Dangling from one of them is a high-beam motorist jacket, a gilet jaune. Christine Capdeville is the communist mayor of Le Pin-sur-Huet. When I ask her what she thinks of President Macron's solution to the crisis, she laughs. "President Macron has ignored us from the moment he came to power," she says, "and now, all of a sudden, he wants us to come to this rescue. He wants to come to his rescue. Wants us to come to his rescue." "Can I be honest with you?" she asks. "The idea of a national consultation is absolute rubbish. We're going to get a piece of paper asking for our grievances, and that's it. Then everything will carry on just like before." The call has gone out for another day of national protest. The fifth consecutive weekend for Gilets Jaunes, or Act 5 as it's being called. Franck is already planning to come back to Paris with his friends to see more of the action. "The violence he saw last week near Republic will stay with him for the rest of his life," he says, but he liked the atmosphere. "Everyone is getting together. We are all one, a very good team. It's not every day you see that." That sense of unity among the protesters is what has given the movement its energy and its power. Sylvie and Christophe arrived on the Champs-Élysées last Saturday at 9 a.m. I met them walking up the near-empty boulevard towards the Arc de Triomphe with a group of friends. "She's far left," Christophe told me, "and I'm far right, and we're here together for the Gilets Jaunes." "That's what Macron doesn't like," he continued. "We're united. He's brought back solidarity among the French. He's turned everyone against him. We're united in combat, at least for now. After that, who knows?" "Our strength is that we're apolitical," Sylvie said. "Maybe later, when there are new presidential elections, we'll put together a leaflet. But for the moment, we don't need a leader. That's our strength." "Are you scared there might be violence here today?" I asked her. "No," she replied. "We have nothing left to lose." President Macron won last year's election by cannibalizing France's traditional center-right and center-left parties. He deepened splits within the remaining opposition and has helped keep the political opposition in check ever since. Now the divided opposition has been replaced by a social movement that has also united people from the left and right in the same way Macron did, along with many of those who are disillusioned with traditional politics altogether. Bruno Bonnell is an MP and founder member of the president's party, La République en Marche. He says the Gilets Jaunes could emerge as the new opposition to Macron. "This movement looks like ours did originally," he said in the lobby of the National Assembly. I remember in Meshare when people were saying we had no program and we didn't know where we were going. We were debating in bars and cafes, trying to reinvent the world. This movement is more about resistance. It's populist like the Five Star Movement or Podemos. But if they gather more effectively with leaders and representatives, then we'll finally fix a clear opposition. He said he had visited protest site many times to ask specifically what demonstrators wanted, but that every proposal he made was rejected. We are now beyond that. It's a political conversation, not a conversation about money or compassion. Some protesters see a future as a political party, but so far diversity has been the movement's appeal, the right of each of its 10,000 members to speak only for themselves. Distrust of representatives and is so strong that even the few spokespeople to emerge have come under heavy criticism, even death threats. But without a leader or a cohesive agenda, what future does this movement have? The leader ought to be the president of France, Anthony Joubert, one of the founders of the movement, said. It's he who has to understand us. He should be spending his time listening instead of creating a situation where restaurants can charge 15 euros for a bottle of water. As things stand, the Gilets Jaunes are leading ourselves. We are an assembly. We are a national assembly. Back at the barricade at Le Chiate, Anthony Ole has gravitated towards the makeshift barbecue as some of the protesters watch a few small piles of sardine crisp on the coals. There's talk about the next protest. Some in Ciote say they're planning to demonstrate here rather than make the trip up to Paris. Many have cautioned against dismissing the movement too quickly. Even if the level of protest and violence in the capital fails, the absence of a complete eruption last Saturday doesn't mean the protest is easy, cautioned the Daily Le Figaro earlier this week. The president won't win over the country by pulling out his checkbook or flaunting his intellect. He needs to open his heart. But we want a second revolution, Ole says. We want to show the rest of Europe that the people have some power. France was seen from the outside as having avoided a populist revolution 18 months ago. But the election of Emmanuel Macron simply papered over France's problems. Facing them will take a whole lot more. All right, that's from the BBC, December 14th. So since the first article was so long, I'm going to skip directly here to the end. In closing, if you haven't gotten a sense of what is needed more than anything else here to produce a great podcast, is that you need to contribute. I need you to send me clippings of articles that you think would link to the working class movement. I need book reviews and recommendations. I need to know the best working class freedom movement sites on the web. I need to be made aware of what is going on in your community toward helping the working class battle the parasitic rich. I need you to email me what you're thinking or your opinions are regarding the show and the struggle. I need you to tell me in general what you, the listener, want out of this podcast. For this podcast to work, I need this to be a collective project amongst us listening working class members, advocates, and the unemployed workers among us. I would like to also respond to some of your emails and share them with our fellow listeners. And if you have the Anchor app on your iPhone or Android, through the Anchor app you can actually leave a voice message that I would be able to play on the next podcast. I would also like to put together a segment with interviews. I can interview leaders, professionals, lecturers, and fellow workers who fight for the freedom of the working class. I would be interested in interviewing some of you, the listeners, who have something to say. Thank you for listening to episode 5 of Working Class Park, and I hope you subscribe. I'll be conducting each episode on the Saturday of each week from here on out, and we may feature the occasional episode during the week. You can now also find the show on all the major podcast hosting sites across the web. If it's easier to find our podcast somewhere other than anchor.fm or the Anchor app, you can just search for Working Class Park over at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other sites. You also can like our Facebook page over at Working Class Spark and hit the email button to reach us, or you can email us directly at workingclasspark1@gmail.com. But the only way to contact us and leave a voicemail message will be through the Anchor app. You can also now find Working Class Spark over at Instagram, also at Working Class Spark. I look forward to getting your responses. Thank you, and let's keep sparking the working class.